Hello, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast with the warning label, No Touch Todd Could Be Dangerous. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
I'm here too. How can I come back from that?
And we're taking a helicopter down to Antarctica to battle the Seeds of Doom.
If you like.
Oh, Todd is mine.
I've been
gifted with this one, which is coming for, surprisingly, we loved this, and it was one of the very later ones to be released on DVD because fan lore says it's just terrific. And yet, in later fan criticism, the gods who criticise, such as Tat Wood and such as Sandifer and such as Nathan Bottomley and Todd, well, I don't know, I'm kind of with them as well. Tonally, it doesn't quite fit with the nature of what we understand Doctor Who to be, because it's so violent. And it is a lot of other films. But then we've also, if you've deigned to listen to the entirety of this podcast, we've always said Doctor Who has been great because it's never been so much about Doctor Who, but about everything else being within the realm of the Doctor Who universe. So this is a lot of other films and a lot of other ideas then put under the Doctor Who umbrella.
So it is hugely popular. And, you know, for the 50th anniversary, DWM, you know, Doctor Who magazine did a poll the first 50 years. I've referred to it before. Mm-hmm. This came 20th out of 241 stories. It is massively popular. But as Richard says, both Tat Wood and Philip Sandifer, Tat Wood says it's his least favourite story of Tom's first six seasons. Philip Sandifer thinks that the violence in it is irresponsible, but in fact, we see Hinchcliffe taken off the programme essentially at the end of next year, partly because of an outcry from the Mary Whitehouse.
Or is it because that Target, because we're still on the topic of violence, which was the BBC's answer to an incredibly popular thing that the Avengers producers were doing called The Professionals with Lewis Collins and Martin Short. And that was the nature of TV at the time. It was gritty ultra-violence, urban realistic violence, I should say. And really, Doctor Who's just responding to that.
That's right. But when Hinchcliffe gets taken off and Williams replaces him, you know, he's told that he's not to do that violence and horror anymore. Yeah. There's kind of a direct...
Right,
so Sandifer sees Hinchcliffe as irresponsibly playing with fire by making a story quite as violent as this. But what's violent about it exactly? Like, why do people say this?
It's the physical violence that is actually repeatable by children. And come on, that composter is pretty severe.
But even before we get there, we've got quite extreme body horror, and I would say even worse body horror than in the Ark in Space, because the crinoid makeup for when it's taking over a person, because it's plant-based, it's easier to replicate than an alien life form, obviously. So it looks more convincing. And the later horror anthology film Creepshow would do a similar plotline with vegetation growing on someone. And again, even though the effects in that are better, the horror still remains in this case. So we have that. We have the Doctor and Sarah being tied to various bombs over the course of the story. Things that are going
to blow up. I love it when they tie people to bombs. You know, I'm a huge fan of that.
We've got Scorby, and until now, sort of villains and henchmen in colour Doctor Who often have a sense of humour or a wry sense of humour. As we saw with Solon last story, he's quite funny and witty. Scorby doesn't have any real wit about him. You know, he's actually a really nasty character, which is funny, because when you see John Chalice interviewed, John Chalice is very plummy and hello. And,
oh, is he really?
Yeah. He actually says that he had this rough-looking face. Yeah. So when he was out in pubs, he's like, you know, these very big, heavy men would come up and say,
Want to dance?
he actually says, then come up and say, I want to buy you a drink. And he's like, okay. And saw it as a bit of an acting challenge to then not totally misrepresent himself, but to at least, you know, chop off his words and what have you. But he said that helped him immeasurably with when he got these heavy type roles. And he's like, you know, it's amazing because I look like a heavy, but there's nothing about that with me in real life.
But the Scorby character is lifted, this is what we're referring to earlier, lifted directly from the current schedules of other television and
yeah,
films.
Yeah, absolutely. He's very professional.
Well, there were questions in Parliament at the time about these British mercenaries that were in the Angolan War, which only lasted 20 days, but there were a whole lot of problems with British and Irish military men who really were too whacked, as in psychotic, to stay in the army. The British Army were having a purge at the time of recalcitrants, shall we say. So in all the turf wars and the oil wars in the Middle East, it was full of Brits and Irish psychos, and it was so known and so reported on that it was being repeated in films and television.
And he explicitly says he's been in the Middle East.
He does, exactly. It directly references that because there were questions in Parliament at the time, so it was on the news. But it's funny that you mention those films because, of course, we haven't got to the greatest villain of probably all time, Harrison Chase.
Well, we have now our first question for this episode from Todd.
Knees together, Todd, we can sit up here.
I can't believe that I am stuck here in my time bubble whilst you guys get to talk about one of my most favourite stories of all time. One of the strengths of this production are the supporting characters and how they are portrayed. In particular, Mr. Dunbar, Hargreaves the butler, and Mr. Keeler. All three actors give tremendous performances. Obviously, three of the most memorable performances in Doctor Who are those of Harrison Chase, Scorby, and Amelia Dukar. In fact, Richard, I think you are Amelia Dukar. And despite everything, I really wanted Scorby to live. Your thoughts, gentlemen?
I have to say that, again, one of the reasons this story outshines other stories in season 13 is just the incredible set of guest characters, and I think that they're all really interesting. Like, Moberly and Winlet, and they're all terribly disposable, but they're dead quite soon.
But the humour is lovely.
And they are well-drawn for such small characters.
And, and the tonality is exactly right. It feels genuine when they're in that base. Lovely designs, too. Mm.
But you've got Scorby, Dunbar, Amelia Dukart,
Harrison.
Sir Colin Thackeray,
virtual new companion. They asked him off on the job.
Wouldn't that have been great?
Extraordinary.
He would have been terrific in Mask of Mandragora, wouldn't he?
My wife is expecting me home for tea.
And they're all really fun and enjoyable characters, and it really, really matters. You know, there's a kind of boys' own adventure approach where, you know, so long as people have guns and are sort of running around and in peril and stuff, that's entertaining enough. And that gave us Planet of Evil. But here you've got actual, you know, really, really interesting characters and really interesting relationships between characters. Keeler and Scorby are fantastic together. Yes. And Keeler is wonderful. There's a scene where he ties up Stevenson in episode 2 and he says, excuse me, before he ties him up. And then he says, sorry, when he's finished. Yeah. You know, he's delightful. Yeah. Harrison Ford is absolutely uproar. Harrison Ford. One of us was bound to do it. Harrison Chase is uproariously funny. There's that scene again in episode 3, the crinoid's not in it. We're just introduced to Harrison Chase, you know, the Doctor and Sarah are there, and he's playing that terrible, terrible music absolutely straight. Not for a second is there a moment of self-awareness or anything like that in Chase's demeanour. He plays it completely straight, and he's absolutely ridiculous.
I also love, I think it's his very first line, or close to it, what are you doing about the savage art of bonsai?
Mutilation and torture, Mr. Dunbar. For someone who objects to bonsai, there's an awful lot of topiary in his estate.
Maybe he anaesthetizes those plants first.
Before carving them into pyramids.
It's funny that you talk about him playing it straight. Have you seen The Italian Job? It's right to Nathan's left there.
Called Camp Freddy or something?
He is Camp Freddy in that, and one of the best characters in it. So I think that there's some longevity in his character.
He's clearly, you know, he's clearly playing gay.
Oh, he's the anti-Mr. Humphreys from Are You Being Served?
Yes.
But it's a lack of humour and a lack of self-awareness, which is wonderful. He's a great villain.
Yeah, he's hilarious, but at no point is he trying to make a joke.
No. But he has endless funny lines. Remember Dunbar explains that he's taking the bribe because all these, you know, worthless non-entities have been promoted above him. Yeah. And he just goes, yes, that must be most galling. he's just terrific, you know, in every scene he's in. And I think I think the tension in the story, and I think the thing that saves it from the accusation of being too violent, is that there are two things going. There is the professionals, and there's, you know, everyone, including the doctor carrying guns, you know, the private army, the mercenaries, the body horror and stuff. But then there's Amelia Ducard, and there's Sir Colin, and then there's, you know, Harrison Chase, and there's the whole premise. The whole premise is utterly ludicrous. Like, all I can say, or all I can think when I see Harrison Chase's estate is, you know, overrun by men carrying machine guns, is that the Chelsea Flower Show must be just absolute hell in the late 70s. Why does he have a private army? You know, like, is it to prevent people walking on the grass? So the whole thing, that whole thing is so grotesque, you know, the eccentric millionaire obsessed with plants and stuff, and so silly that the script, at least, doesn't want us to read this as being in the real world. Is that
no,
fair?
No, I think you are absolutely right there. And in a way, we're not even in the real world of Doctor Who anymore, because we first see the Doctor in this story. He is reporting to the World Ecology Bureau.
At the BBC Television Centre.
At the BBC Television Centre.
Yes. The World Wide Web.
Yes.
it's a nice segue, isn't it, that Sarah and the Doctor seem to have just come back to Earth and have been there for some little while since called in. He's obviously back with UNIT, or at least hanging about a bit. So.
Well, the thing is, he's not, because his first response when he arrives and starts talking to Sir Colin is, "Where's the Brigadier?" So, and
true.
At least this time we get like one mention of the Brigadier, and that's it. We don't constantly have a sign showing his name as we did in the Android
it's
invasion.
Really, isn't
you know,
it?
It's not that tease for the audience. It's the Brigadier's not in this one, and as we go through, we don't even get perfunctory appearances by anyone else from UNIT. At the end of the story, we do get, I think it's Major Beresford and Sergeant Henderson. Sergeant Henderson is really pretty, but a terrible actor.
He's such a red shirt, though.
He's
you know,
a,
like the
he's
moment he arrives,
it does
know,
make
he's
been
dead.
Said, hasn't it?
It
yes,
does make me wonder.
Does disappear very
it does make me wonder if Sergeant Benton was originally destined for the Mulcher.
Oh, that would have been great.
You know, that would have.
No.
You know, I wouldn't want to see Benton go like that, but that would have added so much more to that last episode.
No, although you know what, I wouldn't have put it past Holmes.
Yeah, the thing is, I would have loved to have then seen the Doctor's reaction to that, because, of course, we haven't had a companion die since Sarah and Katarina, and even then the Doctor didn't have that much emotional investment in them, and neither did we as the audience.
Mm.
You know, having a long-running character being killed off, as they were considering writing out Sarah Jane at this time by killing her off...
Oh,
that would have been a terrible mistake.
Terrible. It absolutely would. But, as we will see in a few months' time, when we're up to that point, when they do that in the show, it does have a very strong emotional impact.
I think we might be talking about Adric.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
So, one of the other huge characters of this story, of course, Amelia Ducard.
Can I again pitch in and say Philip Hinchcliffe novelises this, and it's a great novelisation, the Doctor Who and the Seeds of Doom novelisation, and he nearly completely cuts Amelia out.
Oh.
So we do get the scene, I think, where they consult Amelia about the painting in the boot, which is used to get them to the next plot, but she doesn't get to go undercover into Chase's mansion or any of that sort of stuff.
That's brilliant.
I know. So Hinchcliffe thinks it's padding, and so here I think on the other side, where we've got the sort of camp, silly, so an Avengers-style, you know, world that we're in, the really gun, you know, world is what Hinchcliffe wants from it, because he thinks Amelia's a waste of time, and I think it's what Douglas Camfield wants as the director
as well.
We
start off with Ice Station Zebra and end up in Day of the Truffids, don't we?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and also it's Howard Hawks, the thing from another world.
Have you seen that? That's what thing is the thing, 1951, yes.
Yeah. And also, as we may discuss later, a certain Avengers episode called The Man-Eater of Surrey Green, but we won't talk about that too much today.
And that episode of Are You Being Served when they all bring in the pot plants?
Yes, that's a great one. So, Amelia.
She is just such a wonderful, wonderful character.
Is it actually Amelia Pond, all grown up and old and now...
No, it's Amelia Rumford, the same age.
I wish it wasn't. Why did none of these women end up hanging about in the TARDIS? Because, you know, we could jump forward and say that Tom did want to play around with that kind of thing and have different people coming in.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
They teased him by throwing a line in and then just not carrying it through.
Mm. to start it all off, in the first scene we see her, she is smoking.
She smokes later in, like, Chase's study and stuff.
Yeah, she's smoking all the time. And, you know, I can't recall where we've seen a smoking character in Doctor Who since once or twice in the 60s. And
of course, about the Doctor smoking in the second episode?
Yeah, and of course Ian carries matches, so there's an implication that he smokes. And, of course, smoking isn't cool. Smoking isn't cool, kids who are listening. But because she is a character seemingly from a bygone age, not just because of her age, but because of her demeanour, it evokes that sense of 1940s, 50s films with people in smoking parlours and what have you.
Yeah. And, I'm sure that the actress insisted on it.
Immediately she's set up as the type of character she is with that famous lift from The Importance of Being Earnest. Yes. When she's told the painting was found in a car boot. A car boot? Mm. A Daimler car boot. The car is immaterial!
And yet Hinchcliffe saw that as padding. I'm starting to see the Hinchcliffe era in a very different light, you know. This is not quite as glorious and fun and wonderful as I thought as a child. It is for its tonality and for its visuals. And for doing fresh and exciting new things. But, gee, is it time to have a little bit more lightness of touch in the show?
I think it might be. But it also goes to show that when the Hinchcliffe Holmes team write in a main female character, you can't really count Tessa from the Android Invasion because Tessa isn't really a main character in that. But when you've got Vyra, when you've got Betan, when you've got Amelia Dukar, when you've got the matron in Terror of the Zygons.
Sister Lamont.
They're all characters who push the plot forward and have their own actions going on in the plot. And Amelia Dukar is probably the strongest example of that we've seen so far because she gets that whole spying mission, which we don't... It's so excellent because we don't know it's a spying mission. We think she's just turned up out of the blue and then Sarah gets a message to her and you think, well, how is she going to get... Oh, she's been working for Sir Colin all the time! That's very Avengers as well.
Yeah, it is.
There's a hilarious scene at the very end where it is kind of padding where they're just sitting in Sir Charles's office afterwards and she's volunteering to do other spy missions for the World Ecology Bureau in future.
Wouldn't you have loved to have seen that spin-off?
That would have been great. And she talks about her wartime experience and stuff.
And we all raise an eyebrow.
Sir Colin and Sir Colin and Miss Dukar. That would be so wonderful.
Big finish, get on it.
Oh, no, it is a really strong guest cast. There's not a weak link in the bunch.
Do you know what really works, though, and what pulls it all together? Yes, the actors are great, but I keep coming back to the scoring, and I know that...
wonderful.
Jeffrey Bergen is one of my all-time favourite. I mean, he was a choral composer. We talked about this previously, that his main thing in life was to write choral music, and he did his... musicology degree on Gregorian chants and choral chants. So this one is lovely. And again, we've got beautiful ancient instruments in this. We have a clavichord and reeds, which are then put through a synth, so it's still nice and woo-woo.
And the microphone on the clavichord, he had a clavichord at home, and what he would do at home is he would
that's what I was thinking.
He would put the microphone inside the chamber of the clavichord, right up against the wood that the strings were attached to, and it would produce this very strange, metallic, cold vibrato. Yes. Now, the thing is, the sound engineers at the BBC refused to do that. They said it would damage the microphone, so they put it like a millimetre away, and it completely changed the sound. And he's like, it's not quite what I wanted, but those are those sort of pinging sounds we hear when we're in the Arctic.
Yeah.
Also, he deliberately used classical musicians who he worked with before who weren't necessarily session musicians for television, because Dudley always used session musicians. By using the classical musicians, he's like, that's how I got the sound I wanted, because session musicians are all wonderful, but they're more specialists in modern techniques, and I wanted people who were specialists in classic techniques to give this idea of being ancient and cold.
Oh, because classical session musicians are cold. Well, they also know how to listen to each other, possibly unlike our podcast. There's a lot more tonality and inference and sympathetic, if you want to say that, between the musicians on this score. You can tell they're actually behaving as a chamber orchestra and not merely as a set of disparate parts. It's a beautiful score. It makes it work.
Yeah. The effect of it is, I mean, it is eerie and frightening. And again,
but it's also somnambulistic, and it's sort of rather gorgeous, and you feel as if you're in a waking dream.
Yes. Yeah. Mm, I think if we're going to, you know, say who's on the gun side in this story and who's on the frock side, do you know what I mean? Like, if we've got Canfield and Hinchcliffe.
Have you explained guns and frocks on this podcast before?
We really should at some point.
Yeah.
I keep meaning to put a website up explaining. I own gunsandfrocks.com, so I should really put a web...
How about we give the listeners a 10-second version of what it is to be a gun and what it is to be a frock?
So... it's two ways of watching Doctor Who that were talked about a lot when the New Adventures came out. And the gun way is, you know, Doctor Who is a serious science fiction program. It's action adventure. It's got continuity. You know, it's at its best when it's sort of grim. And I guess, like, if you think about Earthshock, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Then you're thinking gun. Frock is Doctor Who is funny and occasionally silly, that it's got a lot of humour, that part of the fun of watching it is the fun of enjoying the sort of silliness and the campness of the programme.
Androids of Tara.
Well, I'm actually thinking Beryl Reed in Earthshock. And so Gareth Roberts famously said of The New Adventures that he wanted more frocks, less guns. And so this is a very gun story in one sense, because a lot of people with guns, even the Doctor carries a gun. In episode four.
I've got a problem with that as well. Yeah. We haven't touched on that yet. Mm. Yeah.
But they do hang a lantern on the fact that Sarah says you'd never use it. Well, they don't know that.
And it's still carrying that gun for about half of the episode.
Yeah.
And so they're the gun things. I think Jeffrey Bergen has to go in the gun camp for this one, just because his score heightens the horror. You know, there's no hilarious comedy plinky harp music or tubas.
Harrison Chase for that, and his Kraftwerk organ,
his Green Cathedral.
Kerry Blyton does not live here anymore.
And you know, the frock side would be Sir Colin and Amelia and so on.
And Dunbar skirts the line adroitly.
Kenneth Gilbert, poor Dunbar, got chicken pox halfway through filming.
Yes, they had a plague on this episode, on this story, didn't they? A lot of people coming
so
down.
So what happened to him?
Well, they just delayed the second studio for about 3 weeks for him to get better.
Oh.
Yeah.
He's really great. There's a cliffhanger to episode 4, which is when we first see the crinoid properly. So the crinoid's been...
The rubber mattress running towards the camera.
But before that, it's been an axon kind of expertly painted green.
Oh, and you, it looks great.
You can see a fair amount of orange, though, there in close-up still. but then it turns into the giant rubber mattress. And I think that cliffhanger is beautifully directed. It's shot at night. There's heaps of black in the frame because it's Douglas Camfield. Lots of shadow and stuff.
Low angle
with the thing. Sarah screams. You know, Dunbar's just been killed. It's a really, really terrifically memorable cliffhanger, and it is beautifully shot. Like, Camfield may be a gun, but those pictures that he creates are just, they're well composed.
Excellent. Yeah.
You know, beautifully lit.
Work. Really nicely done. I like to think it's the fat bird from the end of Morecambe and Wise in a big latex moo-moo running towards the camera in the end. Thank you all for watching my little show tonight, Doctor. Mark Jones plays voice of the crinoid, but I kind of wish it had been Tony Beckley doing the voice, perhaps in a different tone, but maybe Tony Beckley only has one tone.
You know, there is something so Lovecraftian about the crinoid.
Oh, yes, we haven't talked about Lovecraft, have
we? It's a force from prehistory, so that's obvious enough.
Yes.
But also, one of the big things about Lovecraft's monsters is that they cannot communicate on the same level as humanity. And the crinoid only directly verbally communicates once in the whole story when he's outside the cottage and he's saying, "Give us the doctor and your lives will be spared." And then,
2-for-1 offer this weekend only.
And then it communicates with Chase telepathically, and we're never privy to the conversation.
Chase has sex with the crinoid.
He has that wonderful Barbarella and Pygar moment in the woods, and he goes, "It's all true, I get it all now."
He's lying down there grinning.
He is, isn't he?
Coitally.
Yeah.
I always thought that was stupid as a child, but this time I thought, oh my God.
You get it now.
There's a lot of tendrils in that garden.
But yeah, there is
succulents.
There is something, for want of a better description, there is something unholy and unnatural about
and
it.
And fecund in all its ripe and horrible glory.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an effective villain because of that. Because, you know, the Wirren could be reasoned with because the human portion was still there. The human has been completely subsumed and consumed in the crinoid.
Mm.
You know, you can't reason with the androids in the android invasion, but just knock them over and their faces fall off. You're fine. But yeah, this is an enemy that's completely implacable. And I think what we have here is we have the first of a new tradition of season finale. Because in the Barry Letts tradition of season finale, it was throw everything in the kitchen sink and let's all have a fabulous time.
Unless you're a member of the audience.
Unless you're... In the Tom Baker era, the six-parters are more about let's introduce a massive, massive threat that the Doctor must work harder than he's ever worked before to defeat it. So in this, you know, he's got to eventually use methods he would never normally use, calling in an airstrike against the crinoid. And, you know, next season we'll see him go to drastic lengths and the invasion of time even. You know, drastic lengths once again. It starts to fall apart a bit after that, and we don't really get season finales like that in the 80s. So, but this is the beginning of the all bets are off season finale. Oh, I think we have a time bubble circling round again. Here he comes.
The horror for Sarah Jane Smith continues in this episode. And for the third story in a row, she lists some of the obstacles facing her. We had burn up and re-entry, suffocate on the way down, crushed on impact from the android invasion. We had blinded, attacked by a giant claw and falling down a flight of stairs from the brain of Morbius. And here, at the end of The Seeds of Doom, she lists steam, threatened to be shot a number of times, almost blown up by a huge bomb in Antarctica, the crinoid in all of its form, and almost being turned into a crinoid itself. And then she has to face the mincing machine. And I'm not talking necessarily about Harrison Chase, but he does attack Sarah and then put her into the machine. So do you think enough is enough? Rather than the comedy ending for the season, do you think Sarah should have said, it's time to go, Doctor?
She's into it. She's up for it. She's into it. She is. It's not just Stockholm Syndrome. Sarah seems to really get a great kick. Just how miserable must Croydon really be?
She, of course, is going to lampshade it in her last scene in Hand of Fear, where she lists all of the things that she's sick of happening to her. I actually think it's a mistake, and I think it comes completely from Hinchcliffe's misunderstanding of the premise of the show. You would never, ever be able to do those things to Ian and Barbara because we identified with them too strongly. They were too clearly
Or Audrey Forbes Hamilton or Tom and Barbara in The Good Life. It doesn't happen in other shows for a reason, Philip.
Yeah, because it's unpleasant to watch, you know. Mm-hmm. And so Sarah is becoming less of a character and turning into a plot device.
Well,
and
I actually thought more of an SM toy at this point, really. Yeah, well,
do you know what I mean? She's still likable. You know, the performance is fantastic, all of that.
I actually mean that quite seriously, that if we again go to Sasha Masoch, and we've already mentioned Venus in Furs previously, is a great seminal novel on the notion of the subversion of the female archetype to a sexual dominant stereotype, but also one that is... the passive and the dominant become the one thing. It's a complex thing. But she actually does become objectified in the most anti-feminist way you can imagine. She's a figure to be oppressed and dominated and repelled and humiliated and tortured. That's kind of not really great, Phil.
No, and I don't want to agree with that very much, but I think it's probably an unavoidable conclusion. And given just the...
It's a kink.
...massive underrepresentation of women in the entire era, the massive lack of interest that Hinchcliffe and Holmes have, even in including women just for variety, maybe you're right, that maybe there is something really unpleasant about mistreating the female lead over and over again.
Can you imagine any of this having been done to Jo Grant?
No. And, I mean, Jo Grant did face horrors, and I think this highlights the problem with getting rid of Ian Marta, because Jo faced horrors, but the Brigadier faced horrors alongside her, and so did Mike Yates, and so did Sergeant Benton.
Yes.
Now, if Harry was still there, he would be able to get, if you like, his share of the horror, like putting his foot in the clam and getting tortured by Davros and getting poked along by Vogons with guns.
So to speak, yes.
Yeah, getting captured by Hilda Winters. You know, those are all examples of things that happened to Harry, losing his shoes. But,
terrible thing.
You know, if he was there in that season and, say, in Brain of Morbius, Sarah got blinded but Harry fell down the stairs.
Yeah.
In Terror of the Zygons, I mean, Harry gets shot and Sarah gets suffocated. If that had happened to one character alone, that would be absolutely horrible and horrific, you know. Mm. There are other problems with getting rid of Ian Marter in that he's just fabulous and they were a really good triumvirate. But, yeah, I think if you're going to have the one companion, you have to lessen the amount of jeopardy they are put in, because it just becomes unbelievable that they would allow themselves to keep being put in this jeopardy, as we'll later see with Tegan. Tegan leaves for exactly that reason.
So, you know, I don't think the old show, the classic series, asks itself the question very much of why the companions are travelling with the Doctor. And initially the premise was that they were doing it because they couldn't get home, because he can't control it. But Sarah has had a couple of opportunities to leave now, and the show just doesn't even ask the question why he's travelling with her. And we can leap in and say, you know, Tom and Liz smile at each other a lot, so Sarah's travelling with the Doctor because she really likes him. But the show never explicitly makes that claim.
Yeah.
It really isn't interested. She's there because you need a female lead. She's there because Liz Sladen's contract isn't up yet.
Oh.
You know, that's really the only reason why Sarah is travelling with the Doctor. Liz is fantastic. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, terrific. I mean, we're lucky that she is such a great character and such a wonderful actress that we really like watching her. And even when she's given these unrealistic, and I mean unrealistic in the sense of why are you still there, things to do, we still find her compelling and interesting and captivating. But it's a detriment to the character and the thought processes therein.
It's an imbalance, and it's a misdirection. She has an inquisitive nature. She's a reporter, but I don't know that that's enough to compel the characters.
And certainly they never suggest that that's the reason. Do you know what I mean? We're having to leap in and write our own reason, and there isn't really a good one, I think.
Quick question. Is this the best season we've had so far?
No.
No?
I thought it was a good one, but I'm really seeing last season as being terrific for all its flaws and rushes. And as Hinchcliffe was always complaining that the so many of his stories were inherited and he didn't really get to do what he wanted to do. This is the first year he said, we got to do exactly what we pleased. Well, I don't know that I'm completely pleased by it.
No, I'm not. And I'm really surprised.
Yeah. Memory cheats. This is not how I recall it. No.
And, of course, with him being such a satisfying villain, we actually get a kind of uncomfortably satisfying end for Harrison Chase. As he's already tried to mulch Sarah, and that hasn't worked. He's mulched Sergeant Henderson, and he tries to mulch the Doctor. Sarah saves the Doctor again. You know, she saves him several times in this story, once again. And in the course of the struggle, Chase gets knocked into the mulcher. The Doctor tries to pull him out, but Chase is trying to pull the Doctor in. So the Doctor has to step away. We get his wonderful deathly scream, which is an absolutely beautiful in terms of terror, it's an absolutely beautiful sound. And we then get, and I think this, it seeks to redress, I'm not sure if it's entirely successful, but it seeks to redress the balance of the season with the Doctor shell-shocked that is saying, I tried to save him, he tried, I tried to save
him. And he kept trying to pull me in.
And for this Doctor, who has been so emotionally distant, as we've seen in Pyramids of Mars, but can be so flippant as well, and usually when he's faced with tragedy, he just sort of stares off into the middle distance. It's a wonderfully human moment from Tom's Doctor, and I think it just enhances an already brilliant story.
The acting in this is impeccable, and that's what saves it, ultimately. That and the score. And there's so much to love about this. It's difficult to say why it isn't quite as beautiful as I remember it to be. It's a hell of a lot more enjoyable for me than Brain of Morbius, probably because visually it's so interesting and aurally it's so interesting. But no, it's certainly not my highlight of the season.
Should we talk about the last scene? It might be the worst season closing scene. Even
it's so
vastly, vastly worse than the Brigadier and Mike Yates.
Why wouldn't
each
you
other
wear a bikini in -20 temperatures?
Or Naked Benton.
Naked Benton. Naked, Naked Benton. Naked yes, Benton. That's a great cliffhanger. So this one tries to do the humour. So they are heading off to Cassiopeia on a holiday. So Sarah's in a bikini. They end up in Antarctica because the Doctor hasn't reprogrammed the coordinates.
Although
even though we went there by helicopter, as everyone knows. Then they're supposed to say a funny line, which isn't funny. So have we been here before or are we yet to come? Which isn't actually a funny line. They're both desperately looking at each other to get the timing right, but they don't manage to do it. So they don't manage to say it at the same time.
You know why they're so hysterical, though? The TARDIS prop roof had fallen in on them.
This is
the last time we see the original 1963 Unearthly Child police box shell. And yes, dear listener, it's been the same prop all the way through, just redressed.
Right.
So yeah, goodbye. No, apparently almost injured Liz Sladen as the roof fell in, and we thought, well, what else could happen to her this season? You know?
Yeah. And then they do the most appalling fake laugh to end the season.
And
of course, it's Antarctica, brilliantly lit. Antarctica doesn't have long days and nights in the Doctor Who universe. We've landed in the daytime. It's brilliantly lit, and of course, it's just some haphazardly sprayed fake snow on sort of black dirt. It looks really, really unconvincing, and so it is. I think the worst season closing scene. In Doctor Who's history.
I think we're getting very close to picks and specs, aren't we?
Yes. So, Nathan, what's your Jenny Laird Award for this season?
Originally, when I thought about this, I thought it had to be Bob Holmes for rewriting Terence Dicks but not rewriting Terry Nation. But I have sort of said that before. And so I'm going to preempt all of your picks because I can just sense what's bubbling under the surface as I look across the table at you, which is utterly wasting Ian Marta, completely squandering
him. Agreed.
And he was such a terrific story. He gets a really perfunctory farewell in Terror of the Zygons. He comes back in Android Invasion, and he just, he doesn't say a word to the Doctor. Robot replica Harry gets to deliver some very boring
lines.
The
script actually had a lot more involvement, and Hinchcliffe cut it all out. It was all at Hinchcliffe's behest, and he and Holmes had yet another blue about it.
So I think I heard something about this. He just thought it was confusing or didn't.
No,
want
he said I
he wanted
don't
to emphasise Sarah. I believe.
He simply said that. He said I don't want the audience is exactly what you're saying. I don't want the audience to regret something they've lost.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I mean, it just causes us to regret.
Of course it does.
And you know, Sarah
gets... puzzling at the age of 10.
Yeah, Sarah gets one line with him, and then the rest of the time he's
bloody
completely
awful,
wasted.
Yeah.
And you've already said this episode, Brendan, how he would have had a salutary effect on the tone of the whole season.
Mm. He and Scorby and a Biffo would have been
terrific.
Wouldn't
have been great. He's funny, you know, he's lovely, and he would have just lightened
he and
what
Amelia
has been
Ducat
grinding.
In a Biffo would have been funny.
He would have taken her out for a lovely drink or something.
You mean just taken her out, just headbutted her and taken her out, and vice versa, I suspect,
Okay, my Jenny Laird Award, it's related to the Android Invasion, which generally I quite like, and I've already talked about the absence of the Brigadier and how it's a cheat for the audience. So my Jenny Laird Award is going to be this. If you're going to have Patrick Newell in there at the end as Colonel Faraday, have him in the replica Earth as well, so his character is established. Because I don't think that Patrick Newell puts in a bad performance. He's just given very, very generic, thankless material. And if he had have been there from the beginning, it might have actually added a bit of mystery as well. It's like, we have a new military leader here.
He's a bit of a coup too, isn't he? Because, of course,
He's famous for playing Mother in the Avengers.
Mm, in the Avengers.
What's his character called again?
Colonel Faraday.
So, if Colonel Faraday and Major Beresford had a fight, who would win?
I think Faraday. He's far more interesting than Beresford.
Beresford's got a great growly voice, though.
Beresford
he really
does have a great growly voice, but it's so one note. Whereas Faraday, in the sort of five lines he gets, we see him happy, we see him impatient, we see him no nonsense, and that is all through his performance.
His
it's not through
very
the dialogue.
Own Meryl Streep.
There's a hole in my stomach. Richard,
is
what's your Jenny Laird?
Is that how he lost all that weight?
Yeah.
Oh, poor old love. He was almost unrecognisable.
Yeah.
It's so odd. I think we've covered it, really, in certainly what you're saying. My Jenny Laird Award was really also the trouble with Harry. And then he's just not there. It was disappointing as a little boy, and it's even more so now. But really, the blinding of Sarah is so the nadir. It's so the bottom line of you've crossed that Hinchcliffe. And again, as a child, I didn't see it.
No.
And I think if this story had
neither
been kept...
Did she.
Exactly. No. She didn't see it coming. Oh, thank you, listener. Did you hear the collective sigh across the interweb? Yes. Yes, it was a texture in the force then. It was all dark grey. If Brain of Morbius had been shown in Australia in the original run, I don't know that I would have enjoyed this season as much. And simply for what's done to Sarah.
It
drops it all out. So, yeah.
Okay, picks of the week. This one isn't strictly Doctor Who related, but when I watched it, it gave me a sense of part of this season. It's a short film called Refuge. And it is a short film that has been shot entirely with moonlight.
Ooh.
It's set on an alien planet, and to get a different lighting effect, they shot with moonlight and reflector boards reflecting the moonlight.
Ooh.
I can't say too much about it, because it is only 7 minutes long. What I found it very evocative of was Planet of Evil. So it's up on Vimeo, we'll include a link to it on the website. I will say that it does have a level of violence and a level of body horror. So please be aware of that as you watch it. I wouldn't say there was anything you couldn't put in an M15 film. Probably a PG film, to be honest. But yeah, I do recommend it. Refuge, short film, shot entirely in moonlight at, I believe, 51,000 ISO to capture the lighting effect. And just done with just three actors and minimal special effects. It's really good.
Well, my one is a little bit more prosaic than that. Yours sounds intriguing, though, Brendan, I have to say. I hear it, Richards, and like all of us, he has boxes of old issues of DWM around the place.
Yes, we do.
And I'd subscribed to it and had it sent to me from, at great expense from England. It turns out that there is an app for the iPad, which is the DWM app. It's vastly cheaper to buy individual issues. Mm-hmm. They're weightless. You can have them with you at all times, and they don't pile up in big dusty boxes in your attic. So that's what I've been doing. I've downloaded it. I've got it with me at all times, and so I don't even have to read it. So can I recommend the DWM app for the
iPad?
That's
actually great, because I buy them and don't take them out of the plastic more often than not.
Yeah, I believe the subscription rate is $50 Australian for a year. And if you would like to read the interview with Robert Banks Stewart, the writer of Terror of the Zygons and Seeds of Doom from this season, that is in issue 443.
Brilliant.
Because I had a quick look at that in preparation for the podcast.
It's good to know. Well, my pick is, again, Doctor Who related, not, but sort of ish, and from my least favourite story of the season, Brain of Morbius. But I really love the antecedents of this story, and one of my favourite takes on that whole wonderful universal period of horror, which is a lovely filmic thing in and of itself, and imbues so much of this season's atmosphere, just as much in Seeds of Doom, actually. Bill Condon is a director who's been around for about 20 or so years. He does really nice, interesting, quirky little things off the fringe. He did a beautiful film with Brendan Fraser, Ian McKellen, and our very own Pamela Salem called Gods and Monsters in the late 90s, which is the story of James Whale and a young man he met called Brendan Fraser. and it's mostly shot around a swimming pool. The director of Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, and it's set around the filming of Bride of Frankenstein, and it's just a beautiful story of old Hollywood, and introduces a very young Brendan Fraser, who is delightful in the part. And yes, we have Pamela Salem as James Whale's wife, and a lot of other things. Gods and Monsters, it's called. I saw it at at its premiere in Sydney at one of the film festivals, and I asked Bill Condon, who was a sort of early archetype of the hipster set in tweed jacket and big bushy beard, and he was very comely, and I asked him out afterwards. I said, "What are you doing after this?" And he said, "Queen of the Jews!" And I said, "No, it's just a trick of the light." But that was the film he made next. I don't know if it ever got released.
That's all the time we have for this season. We will be back next week, but doing something slightly different, and Richard's talk of antecedents is actually what's inspiring us next week to have a look at the Avengers episode, The Maneater of Surrey Green.
Ooh, so, have a drink, listener.
So you have a week to track yourself down a copy of the episode. It is available as part of various Series 4 Avengers sets. They're available on DVD and Blu-ray from Amazon UK.
It is actually on YouTube.
It is on YouTube.
In its entirety, and I will put a link in the show notes so that you can prepare for next week's episode by watching it.
There we go. Because many believe that it has some very strong links to the Seeds of Doom, so we'll be exploring that as well. The week after that, however, we will be back on with The Mask of Mandragora, and Todd will rejoin us again for Season 14.
Hooray.
Until then, please check us out on flightthroughentirety.com, at FDE Podcast on Twitter, and Flight Through Entirety on Facebook and iTunes. And we would like to thank the listeners who have left us reviews so far. We now have an aggregate iTunes rating. So thank you very much for that, because you need a minimum amount of reviews for that. So thank you, all of those of you who have left reviews so far. Until next week, do take care of yourselves. And remember, no touch Todd could be dangerous. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
You have been listening to Flight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Playing It Straight, was recorded on July the 11th, 2015. The next episode will be released on September 6th. Have you listened to Bondfinger yet? Or are you yet to come to the Bondfinger website that wasn't an innuendo? I'm gonna go. I'll see you next week.
Well, I'm sick of being trapped in my time bubble, so I'm off to the Mandragora Helix. They've promised me a way to get back to Earth in time for Season 14. Let's see if I make it.